Yukon Quest dogs know how to climb hills. I'll tell you that much. So do Yukon Quest mushers.
Allie Zirkel and Mitch Seavey battle for the Iditarod win. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the court case against GCI's plan to take over three television stations across the state.
When you mix distribution and content, we want to make sure there's a level playing field because distributors can squeeze out content providers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Mitch Seavey left the Iditarod checkpoint of White Mountain at 1:11 this afternoon. Allie Zirkel followed 13 minutes later. According to GPS, she is currently running about 1 mile behind Seavey. Seavey is a former Iditarod champion. Zirkel's best finish in the race was second last year. By 6:30 tonight, the tightly grouped top 10 mushers in the field should all be on the final stretch of trail to Nome. APRN trail reporter Emily Schwing talked to the top mushers as they rested today in White Mountain. She says Seavey says he isn't going to push his dogs too much on the final run.
That he runs his dogs at the speed that they like to go. And he said, this far into the race and this far into the season, they can do that for a long time. He also said that he's confident that he can win, but he's not going to be unrealistic about the team that's coming up behind him. As far as Allie Zirkel goes, she is just excited. I think she's really excited about where she is in this race. She knows that there's not a lot of time that she needs to make up on Mitch. They did share a couple words in the dog yard when they were getting their dogs ready to go, and they just sort of talked about the competition. Mitch said maybe it doesn't have to be as stressful as they think it does, and Allie made some jokes about how it was nothing like Hugh Neff and Alan Moore, who is Allie's partner, both in life and in the kennel, when they were going at it for the Yukon Quest last month.
Emily, you weren't able to see Mitch Seavey and Allie Zirkel and their teams leave White Mountain, but you did see them come in. How are their teams looking at this point?
The teams did look different when they came in. I could tell that Mitch's team was tired, and Mitch admitted that they were tired. Allie also said that everybody on her team, including herself, needed sleep. But her dogs, you know, they're a little peppier and they're a little bit more alert. They have been at every checkpoint I've seen them come into this race. And they just sort of looked around and it seemed like they were really happy to see everybody. Later, after everybody had had a little bit of rest, both Allie and Mitch were out in the dog yard. Mitch didn't have his dogs up, but Allie had her dogs up, and she was getting ready to feed them. And, you know, they just kind of popped up and knew what was going on and knew it was time to eat something. And they're pretty familiar with what needs to happen next, I think. All of them are veterans.
Mitch Seavey beat Allie Zirkel to White Mountain, but not by much. Zirkel was ecstatic to arrive in the checkpoint so close to the race leader. Schwing was there when both teams pulled in early this morning and has this report.
It was after 5 a.m. before a light was finally spotted as it rounded a bend along the Fish River. Locals at the village of White Mountain ring the church bell when the first Iditarod musher comes through their community. The light belonged to Mitch Seavey, who arrived visibly tired and ready for his 8-hour mandatory rest.
Thank you. What time is it?
13 minutes later, Allie Zirkel pulled into the checkpoint, jumping up and down on the back of her sled. She was clearly pleased with her run.
Lucky number 13.
This is Zirkel's 13th Iditarod. She's running a team of dogs who came off the Yukon Quest last month.
Holy cow, there are some hills out there. But the Yukon Quest dogs know how to climb hills. I'll tell you that much. So do Yukon Quest mushers.
Teams run along a tough portage trail out of Elam. They climb over a steep hill called Little McKinley. Zirkle's hands are reportedly covered in blisters after using her ski pole to help her team climb over the series of hills. She knew CV was ahead of her, but she didn't know by how much. She did know he wasn't using his feet to push.
You can look in the snow and see only every once in a while his footprints.
When Jeff King pulled into White Mountain, he said whoever was running in front of him worked hard to stay ahead.
Going over the hills, his footprints, I just went, oh my God. Every little hill had footprints right next to each other.
Over a heaping plate of lasagna in the checkpoint, King said he still planned to win the race. He says running as the rabbit is nerve-wracking, but he gets a kick out of chasing down the competition. On the Iditarod Trail in White Mountain, I'm Emily Schwing.
Three veteran mushers scratched from the Iditarod today, Jason Mackey, Robert Bunsen, and Rudy Demoski Sr. So far, seven mushers have scratched from the race and one has been withdrawn. The race leaders are expected in Nome between 10 p.m. and midnight tonight. At today's prices, Alaska's oil tax system can be compared to those of Norway, Russia, and Venezuela in terms of how much money it puts in state coffers. A plan introduced by the Senate Finance Committee today would change that. It's a new version of the oil tax plan Governor Parnell introduced earlier this session. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Under the Senate Finance Committee's substitute, companies would pay lower taxes on oil from the North Slope than they do on shale from the Eagle Ford Formation in Texas, the Haynesville Formation in Louisiana, or the Bakken Formation in North Dakota. PFC Energy, a consulting firm, presented charts showing as much before the Finance Committee on Tuesday afternoon. Their analysis prompted a question from co-chair Kevin Meyer, a Republican from Anchorage.
You've proven the point, anyway, that we're competitive. I guess now the next concern will be what's it going to cost us to get there.
Over the next few days, the Finance Committee will be working to figure just that out. Their new bill, in some ways, is a mix of Governor Sean Parnell's initial bill to cut oil taxes and a rewrite done by the Senate's Resources Committee in February. The finance version would bump the base tax rate on oil production from 25% up to 30%, instead of all the way to 35% like the Resources Committee wanted. But like the Resources Bill, it gives oil companies a $5 credit for every barrel they produce. And like both earlier versions of the oil tax plan, it scraps a mechanism known as progressivity, which increases taxes as the price per barrel goes up. The new version of the bill also gets rid of a change to increase a tax break on oil from new fields, but their bill does make it so that credit can be applied to new oil from fields that are already developed. Meyer says that's to encourage new production no matter where it happens.
But if it's new oil that's not currently being produced, then yes. And it doesn't matter to us if it's coming from a legacy field or coming outside of the legacy field.
That specific change prompted criticism from some Democrats. Senator Bill Willikowski of Anchorage has been stumping on the issue of oil taxes, and he thinks that tax break doesn't need to be applied to legacy fields.
In new fields, it's a good thing. In new participating areas, it's a good thing. You don't need it in the legacy fields. The legacy fields are where 90% of our oil projections for the next decade are coming from. The Senate finance version gives them a massive tax break for oil that they're already planning to produce.
Willikowski also says that any version of oil tax reform that passes the legislature should keep the progressivity mechanism intact, and he has concerns that the bill hasn't been properly vetted. The next step for the Finance Committee is getting an analysis from the Department of Revenue on what their bill does to the state's treasury at forecasted levels of oil production. This week, they'll also be hearing testimony on the bill from the public and industry players. Meyer says that because he hasn't seen hard projections on just how their bill will affect production, testimony from oil companies will be especially important to him.
Obviously, if we're not going to have increased production, then we're kind of wasting our time here. But I know that's a hard forecast for you guys to make, and that's why I'd like to hear from the industry.
Meyer says that the oil tax bill could be on the Senate floor as early as next week. The governor's office is still reviewing the Finance Committee's version of the oil tax bill and does not have comment on their proposal yet. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Fairbanks hosts the Junior National Cross Country Ski Championships.
I managed to make it through without falling, so that was my main goal. Didn't fly into the woods at all.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, information systems, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Commercial fishermen and tour operators from Southeast Alaska are in Washington, D.C. this week, lobbying Congress to strengthen the protections of certain areas of the Tongass National Forest. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
The Tongass National Forest stretches 500 miles along the Southeast Panhandle. It's the largest national forest in the country, and it's part of one of the world's most productive salmon fisheries.
The economy's really transitioned to this, like, healthy, replenishable fishery.
Jesse Raymond fishes with his family off the southern tip of Baranoff Island. He says the region has moved beyond timber. In fact, he doesn't know anyone who works in logging anymore. His family fishes black cod and halibut, also coho salmon. Raymond is in Washington, D.C. this week, meeting with congressional staffs, pushing them to upgrade the protective status of some 1.9 million acres in the Tongass.
We would like to see these 77 watersheds as a start protected, and it's just under 2 million acres, so we're not trying to cut off possibility for all development.
The trip is organized by the advocacy group Trout Unlimited. It hopes Congress will officially designate the 77 watersheds, which are scattered throughout the forest from north of Yakutat to south of Ketchikan, as Land Use Designation 2, LUD 2 in Washington speak. Unlike wilderness status, LUD 2 allows some limited development. Matt Boleen runs a fly fishing company in Juneau. He takes tourists off the cruise ships into the forest on float planes. It's a catch-and-release bit. He says people pay to catch fish. They don't want to fork over money and not catch anything. He likes to take them where he knows they'll get bites, including some of the 77 watersheds he'd like to see upgraded. He says 60 of them have never been logged or have no roads.
The heart of this is that we're trying to protect something that's not broken yet rather than going back and fixing something later after we've screwed it up.
The timber industry, much of which was effectively idle in the mid-90s, would love to get into the old-growth forest. So Owen Graham calls the increased protection totally unnecessary. He's the executive director of the Alaska Forest Association.
We don't have enough access to timber resources to keep more than like one sawmill open in a region that's the largest national forest in the country.
He says the state and federal governments have enacted sufficient protections for salmon habitat, and 77 new protected watersheds would not increase the health of the fish population. His main concern, getting people back to work in logging jobs.
We've gone from about 3,000 or 4,000 people direct jobs in our timber industry down to somewhere between 400 and 600 people.
And the timber industry has an ally in the U.S. Forest Service, at least on this issue. Wayne Owen is a director with the Forest Service. He says the Tongass National Forest already has various land use designations designed to protect salmon.
We have a substantial amount of wilderness on the Tongass National Forest. There are a lot of roadless areas that protect salmon. And frankly, a lot of the northern part of the Tongass, where a number of these watersheds are not actively managed. There's not a lot of ground-disturbing activities in them. For the most part, we're doing a very good job.
Trout Unlimited brought forward a similar plan last Congress, only to see it fade. This time around, it says it's more optimistic it will gain traction. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
It may be months before the Federal Communications Commission rules on GCI's application to take over two small television stations in southeast Alaska and one in Anchorage. Commercial broadcasters have lined up to oppose the purchase and request a hearing before the commission, something the FCC is often reluctant to do. As KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports, the question hinges on whether the merger is in the public's interest.
Juneau resident Walter Gregg is old enough to remember when television in Alaska was all tape delayed.
We didn't watch the moon landing live. We got it later, and not very high quality.
Gregg lives in downtown Juneau and is a regular viewer of five major network stations over the air. In November, GCI announced that its subsidiary, Denali Media Holdings, would buy low-power NBC affiliates in Juneau and Sitka, as well as the Anchorage CBS station. The stations are picked up in parts of their respective communities by television antenna for free. Now Gregg wonders if he'll eventually have to pay to watch NBC and CBS on GCI cable.
I had a gut reaction against what they were doing just from the standpoint of, oh my gosh, the cable company is going to own the broadcast stations too.
Gregg has written a letter to the FCC protesting GCI's purchase. GCI has not stated its intention for the stations, except to become, quote, a news and entertainment leader unparalleled in Alaska. That worries Alaska commercial television licensees who will compete over the air and on cable. GCI claims it is capable of serving 80% of Alaska households with voice, video, and broadband. It already has a 70% share of the consumer broadband market.
GCI is really a monopoly in cable TV and broadband in this state, and very strong in wireless.
Andrew McLeod is president and general manager of KTUU in Anchorage, an NBC affiliate. KTUU and four other licensees of television stations in Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks recently submitted a petition to the FCC asking it to deny GCI's purchase. Anchorage station KYES has filed a separate petition. McLeod says the broadcasters welcome competition, but doubts that a distribution company as large as GCI could compete fairly.
When you mix distribution and content, we want to make sure there's a level playing field because distributors can squeeze out content providers like us who provide news and entertainment via their strength in distribution.
GCI is leasing space in the Anchorage Daily News building for a news department. The company has hired former KTUU News Director John Tracy to help create a news division. Tracy is now co-owner of advertising agency Bradley Reed & Associates. GCI spokesman David Morris says the company's entry into the broadcast market will increase competition.
It's our goal to create a premier news and information company. We plan to roll out high definition, and we think that's what consumers want. And to the extent that that stimulates other broadcasters to become more competitive, we think that's a good thing.
The broadcaster's petition to deny compares GCI's application to Comcast's 2011 acquisition of NBC Universal. Comcast was already one of the nation's largest communications companies, and the FCC required a number of conditions limiting competition between cable and broadcast television. KTUU's McLeod calls the conditions safety guides.
So that a strong distribution company like Comcast couldn't operate a content company and disadvantage all the other content companies.
Angela Campbell is a communications attorney and professor at Georgetown University Law School in Washington, D.C. Over the years, she has filed numerous challenges to applications before the Federal Communications Commission. Campbell believes the Comcast-NBC case does provide precedent, but in all cases before the FCC...
The question really is this in the public interest?
That is, how would it benefit the market served by the TV stations? While broadcasters argue GCI's television station takeover would put too much power in the hands of one company, GCI's qualification to assume the licenses is not being challenged, and the FCC has thrown out a rule that once prohibited ownership of a cable and television station in the same market.
This is a much harder case for the challengers to win because they don't have a specific rule to help them.
Campbell says the current FCC looks more favorably on the cable industry than have past commissions, and it's very interested in expanding broadband, which GCI has been steadily doing throughout the state. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The Anchorage Assembly voted 6-3 to shut down public testimony on a controversial proposal that would limit city unions last night. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Testimony was some of the most heated and emotional yet in the month-long debate. Workers outlined details of their jobs in an attempt to convey their value to the assembly. And a labor law expert pointed out problems with the ordinance, claiming it would bring lawsuits to the municipality. Some who testified warned assembly members that voters were watching them and would retaliate come election day. Toward the end of the meeting, Assemblymember Paul Honeman motioned to allow public testimony to continue. When Chairman Ernie Hall tallied the votes, the audience protested.
We've got 6 no, 3 yes, and 1 excuse, so the motion fails.
Thank you for respecting us, sir. What is my right?
The proposed ordinance was announced on February 8th by Mayor Dan Sullivan. It would limit union longevity and performance pay, benefits, and eliminate binding arbitration along with strikes. It would also allow some municipal jobs to be contracted out. Sullivan says the changes are needed to keep costs down, and the ordinance must be rushed because of upcoming union negotiations. Friday, union leaders representing 2,200 or so municipal employees offered a 1-year wage freeze in exchange for tabling of the ordinance. After continuing public testimony was voted down, Sergeant Gerard Aslan, who represents the Anchorage Police Department Employee Association, offered this comment. He said the assembly was breaking its own code by limiting testimony.
Under municipal code, it provides that the chair shall instruct people, public speakers, to be brief, but it does not contain any provision allowing the chair to limit certain people who wish to speak to zero time.
Chairman Hall calls the assembly action legal despite a letter from the ACLU of Alaska that warned it would be improper to shut down testimony before everyone had a chance to speak. After listening to 4 5-hour evenings of public testimony from well over 300 people, Hall was ready to look at what the municipal charter says in a different way than the ACLU.
No, I don't think I'm in conflict with municipal code. Municipal code says reasonable time. At the end of the meeting, another 300 or 400 people stood up and said they hadn't had a chance to testify yet. It appeared that it turned into an opportunity to filibuster. And we just got to the point that we're after 20 hours. What the charter says is reasonable time. And we felt that we had given reasonable time and chose to close.
Hall says he's consulted municipal attorneys on the matter and is confident they made the right decision. The assembly is postponing final action on the ordinance until March 26th, and Hall says people still have time to contact assembly members and to submit written testimony to the clerk. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Junior National Cross Country Ski Championships are happening in Fairbanks this week. Several Alaska skiers posted top performances yesterday. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Fairbanks ski conditions in March are often perfect, and Monday's sun, firm-packed snow, and above-zero temperatures did not disappoint, as over 300 of the nation's top junior skiers hit the trails for 5- and 10-kilometer skate ski events.
Looking great.
Coaches implore their charges along grinding courses specifically crafted for these championships to feature steep climbs and hairy descents. Up for grabs are national titles in three age group categories for both sexes. In Monday's Big Boys race, Fairbanks local Logan Hahnemann was the top American and second overall. The University of Alaska Fairbanks sophomore was first in the older junior class, just 3 seconds behind a younger visiting skier from Norway. Hahnemann secured his ninth U.S. junior title after flying in at midnight from the NCAA championships in Vermont.
So I took it easy the first lap, and but then I was hearing that I was actually doing pretty well. So then with the whole crowd, it kind of got kind of probably skied harder than I probably should have for the rest of the week. But no, it was good.
Another Fairbanks local, 15-year-old Max Donaldson, won the boys' 5-kilometer race. The West Valley High student and recently crowned state high school champion says he went out fast from the start, despite not knowing a lot of the competition.
I haven't raced any of these lower 48 guys for, I mean, any of my whole career. So I basically pushed it and that did what I have been doing this whole season.
Donaldson was among several local skiers who said knowing how to ski in Fairbanks conditions was an advantage. Hannah Boyer was third among older juniors in the women's 5K. Boyer, who's in her first year at Northern Michigan University, says it was fun to race at home again.
It was nice and slow with lots of good climbs. The courses were awesome. So that's my kind of skiing. I mean, I'm from the slow snow, so it was nice to be back on it.
Two other Team Alaska skiers were just ahead of Boyer in the women's older junior standings. Stephanie Kirk and Sarah Freistone of Anchorage took first and second. Yesterday's races sent skiers out at 30-second intervals. Kirk said Norwegians that posted the day's fastest times, combined with the hometown crowd, drove the Alaskans.
The Norwegians were right in front, and they kind of just took off. So it was good to have them to give us more competition. But, you know, when your intervals start, you really, no matter what splits you get, you just got to go.
The grinding ascents and tricky downhill corners at Birch Hill worked to some skiers' strengths. Older junior silver medalist Sarah Freistone says it was challenging to stay on your skis.
I managed to make it through without falling, so that was my main goal. Didn't fly into the woods at all, so that was really great. And we have so many coaches out cheering for us, and that was so helpful because they were spread all over the course.
The racing at Junior Nationals continued today with relays. Individual skate technique sprint and classic distance events are scheduled for Thursday and Saturday. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, information systems, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. Parents, be a hero to your kids. Make time to be physically active as a family. Encourage your children to participate in the Alaska Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. All kids need to do is be active 3 times a week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.